From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, how the Russians tried to influence the American presidential election in 2016. We're going to focus on their attempts to amplify conspiracy theories and spread disinformation and get Americans to fight and argue with each other. The researcher Renee D'Resta is our guest. She'll talk about the techniques of weaponizing social media and why we're primed to take the bait. We'll be right back.
Take KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app. Available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the Senate Intelligence Committee wanted to know what the Russians were up to in the American presidential election in 2016, they turned to the country's intelligence agencies, of course, but also to a cybersecurity company called New Knowledge. The company dug through mountains of data to track a Russian organization called the Internet Research Agency. And they wanted to know how the Russians used social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram to affect the outcome of the election. Now, what they found was this massive social influence operation of disinformation, basically. Millions of engagements, tens of millions of people. And they used familiar memes, ideas, and photos, and catchphrases. They infiltrated social groups. And they spread conspiracy theories and egged people on to fight over race and politics. Today in the program, the director of research for New Knowledge is joining us to explain how the Russians used social media to exploit these deep fractures already in place in American society. Renee D'Resta is the director of research at New Knowledge. She also is head of policy at the nonprofit Data for Democracy. And we began with the time D'Resta really became interested in how disinformation spreads on the internet. And for her, at least at first, it was personal.
So I was looking at vaccination rates for my son's schools. You know, you have to put them on these lists, wait lists for daycare and preschool. And I looked at the vaccination rates when I was doing that, and I was very disappointed. And the Disneyland measles outbreak happened quite quickly after that. And I called my state senator, and I said, you know, can't you guys do something about this? And they said, you know, a senator from Sacramento, Dr. Richard Pan, he's going to be introducing a bill. Why don't we put you in touch with his office? It sounds like you're interested in helping. And so I got in touch and I said, well, you know, look, I do data analysis. I'm happy to help with that. I'm happy to help with social media if it's useful. And I connected with a group of other women, and we started to run a group called Vaccinate California. And in the process of participating in the political conversation about the bill on social media, particularly on Twitter and Facebook, we came to realize that although the legislators were telling us that the bill was polling at 85% positive when they would kind of call their district and talk at coffee houses and things like that in the early days of the bill, on social media, it was almost uniformly negative. And it was very, you know, very much kind of these kind of bulk spamming of hashtags with memes and things. A lot of the memes were harassing the legislators in support of the bill. So we were looking at these conversations and the patterns that they were taking and feeling that there was a lot of automation at work. There were a lot of kind of coordinated messaging. There were a lot of accounts that had been set up specifically to talk about this, which, you know, you would expect from new activists. But at the same time, they were sort of almost immediately turned on in this capacity where they were quite clearly in coordination with all of the other accounts. So we started digging into that a little bit more and observed and reported on how this small group of activists, you know, the anti-vaccine movement is quite small in number, but the overwhelming influence they were having on the narrative by being the disproportionate, overwhelming majority of the social media conversation. And so we started looking at this from the standpoint of you know, where is that line between legitimate activism, which you don't want to silence and you do want people to use these platforms to have a voice, but then the sort of mass coordination came to be called later manufacturing consensus, the idea that you could create a perception that an overwhelming majority feel a certain way about an issue by using automation and fake accounts and other things to dominate the conversation on social media. So that was sort of the start.
What is that about, that impulse to want to believe other people believe like you do? Do these people then exploit these kind of human ideas of, you know, confirmation bias, those kinds of things?
Yeah, there was an interesting study. I think it was highlighted maybe in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal that talked about the way that networks organize. And if you believe that the people around you think a certain thing, you are more likely to entertain that as a legitimate point of view, right? Yeah. So this is the kind of concept of the Overton window, maybe in the these are the set of acceptable political opinions in the mainstream or in your community in the world. And then the way the network organizes is interesting because if you have these people, influencers, who are connected to many, many, many people, there's this perception that opinion, which is kind of widely received by many people, has the capacity to influence many people. And the other piece of this is, depending on who you're connected to, you're likely to believe that the majority thinks one way or another based on your personal experience of your social community. So even if you happen to be connected to the only three people in the world who like licorice jelly beans, you would think that the overwhelming majority of the country or your community feels that same way just because that's the information that you're hearing from people. So it's the notion of how do we think about influence when people are connected in digital space to a much broader collection of people.
We'll get back to this when we talk about the particular tactics of the Internet Research Agency. But what did you learn from that anti-vaxxer experience? What did that tell you about how people are inclined toward conspiracies and conspiracy thinking?
Well, it was in some ways less about the people and more about the system. So I don't think that it's revolutionary to say that people like conspiracy theories, right? That the conspiracy theories have been around for, centuries. The interesting thing about it was the way in which the architecture of the social ecosystem amplified those conspiracy theories. And there are a couple of reasons for that. There was, there's first of all, the way I was describing that people organize now. So people organize into groups, for example, on Facebook, or communities on Twitter, who they follow, who they are followed by, who they talk to. So you've gone from having, so you've kind of like expanded the ability of people to find their tribe. So people who are prone to maybe belief in a particular conspiracy theory can find the others who believe in that conspiracy theory, connect with them, and, kind of double down. It becomes kind of a tribal reinforcement. And this is a thing that you hear when you talk to people who kind of exit some of these highly conspiratorial communities. They'll say, this was my entire life. This was everybody I talked to. And I was so happy to find them online because it gave me a connection that I was looking for. And then besides the organizational structure, there's also what the platform gives back. So once you've indicated to the platform that you are interested in being a member of this community or reading this type of content, the platform continues to surface it for you. And that's because the platform is incentivized to keep you on site because it's going to monetize by serving you ads. So it can't monetize you if you're not on the platform. So what they begin to do is the recommendation engine and the feed ranking algorithms key off of what you engage with and what you want to see. So if you demonstrate an interest in a conspiracy theory, the platform is going to continue to give you more. And this is how we see this kind of conspiracy theory cross-pollination happening online, where people who follow the anti-vax movement find their way into the chemtrails groups, and in many cases now find their way into sort of far-right anti-government conspiracies as well. It's because the recommendation engine is actively promoting things like Pizzagate and QAnon, two people who believe in more of the sort of pseudoscience and, traditionally historically lefty conspiracies.
So they're just exploiting impulses that are already there. I mean, one of the things you've talked about is, for example, the Internet Research Agency wasn't creating rifts. They were rifts already in place. They were just good at amplifying them.
Yes, I think that's a lot of what happens is the technology doesn't generate the conspiracy theory. The technology recognizes personal biases or personal proclivities and feeds them. And it's the same way when you talk about the Internet Research Agency, they were creating tribes also. So they you sort of like hang up a shingle, all Texas secessionists come here, right? And then anyone who is prone to that particular line of political thinking, maybe they search it, maybe somebody recommends it to them. In many cases, with the Internet Research Agency, they went out and bought ads to kind of grow their initial audience. So they find ways to reach people who have kind of a kernel of interest in that, and then they are reinforcing the message, kind of consistently building the community, much like what I was describing with the more conspiratorial communities. In this particular case, it's a niche political issue, Texas secession, but you find all the people around Texas, you know, not just in your physical neighborhood, that share that opinion with you. And then the propaganda, the steady drumbeat of propaganda reinforcing your particular point of view and, in fact, kind of nudging you perhaps to be even more extreme.
So you published your findings on the anti-vaccine movement, and then you got the attention of the Obama administration. I wanted you to talk a little bit about this moment. I'm interested in what you were saying to tech companies in those days about their potential, you know, the potential of their platforms to spread this disinformation and whether they were listening. What was that moment like at that particular point?
2015 was very, very different than today. So the Obama administration reached out to me in, I think it was September 2015, and they said, we'd like you to talk to us about parallels that we see between the work that you put out, where small groups of people are spamming hashtags and kind of recruiting members and growing communities and dominating conversations, with what we're seeing with violent extremist groups. Specifically with things like ISIS recruiters who and with the way that ISIS at the time was, I think Vanity Fair called them like the world's deadliest tech startup, right? It was the idea that they were running themselves like a digital marketing agency. And that's the kind of key connection between all of the things that I've done and all the things that I look at is that this is, you know, these are all marketing campaigns for an idea. Propaganda is basically, it's a type of messaging, a messaging about a political idea, messaging about a political concept or a societal concept. But the way that the social media ecosystem was built to facilitate advertising relationships is simply being kind of turned just a little tiny bit. And it's being used to kind of advertise ideas, advertise concepts. And so the same tactics that I was discussing with regard to the anti-vaccine movement and their involvement in political conversations in California, the way that they just wholly dominated the social ecosystem despite being a very small number of people, was what we were seeing with ISIS, what they were seeing with ISIS as well. Yeah. And so they said, there's a group of five or six folks that we're going to bring in from the Valley. We'd like to just talk a little bit about how these algorithms intersect. And at the time, there was a lot of debate in Silicon Valley about speech and moderation.
Yeah.
And at the time, if you go back and you read these articles that were being written there, they're a little bit surreal when you read them in the context of 2018 or now 2019, where the idea was, if we moderate ISIS, what comes next? You know, this notion that it was a huge slippery slope.
Yeah.
And that while beheading videos objectively violated the terms of service because they were, you know, violent, much of their propaganda was not violent. It was just sort of them, you know, pushing their particular extreme views. And the question was, like, you know, do we owe them, you know, under freedom of speech, the right to use these platforms in this way? And so, you know, there were those of us who fell on the side of, you know, no, we shouldn't be letting terrorists, you know, have unfettered access to propagandize, to radicalize people. We're sort of fighting this battle where the tech companies were saying, well, if we take ISIS down, what do we have to take down next? Where do we draw the line? And I think Twitter at the time was called, referred to itself as like the free speech wing of the free speech party.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see how nuance has kind of come into the conversation a couple of years later.
Yeah, you've talked about that as kind of an inflection point, this moment where you had these tech giants and the government, I think, suspicious of each other. I mean, they were the Snowden revelations, and so they were kind of gun-shy. I guess it just seems like we kind of missed an opportunity back then.
I think we did. I think that, you know, some things came out of that. So we had the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism that was established by President Obama via executive order, partly in response to this. That was because there was really a sense that that there was going to be a need to counter-propagandize. Mm-hmm. That also sounds very sensational in the context of 2018, but there was really a belief when we were looking through, like, what are the options, what is the playbook, rather than moderate them or take them down or treat this as a terrorist propaganda, the question was maybe the U.S. government should do a better job growing a counter-movement. Maybe, you know, this was where you had the State Department tweeting at terrorists under the Think Again, Turn Away hashtag, basically responding, like, literally guys in a room sitting, typing, responding to ISIS recruiters with stories of, you know, women who went to Syria and then were disillusioned by what they found there, you know, things like this, which, yes, those stories are true. But I mean, the State Department is not exactly an authentic voice that capable of influencing young, radicalizable men. And so there was this sort of disconnect. But at the time, you know, this was really, well, if the tech companies aren't going to take them down, then what's the next best step is to try to do these counter movements.
That's Renee DiResta. She's director of research at New Knowledge. She's the author of The Disinformation Report. That's an independent investigation for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how the Russians tried to influence the American presidential election. And we're focusing on their attempts to amplify conspiracy theories and spread disinformation on the internet. We're joined by Renee DiResta. She's with New Knowledge. That's a cybersecurity company that specializes in disinformation defense. She was the lead researcher on the Disinformation Report, that's an independent investigation by New Knowledge, for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. She joined us from a studio in San Francisco. So I want to shift over to the work you've done on the Internet Research Agency. I noticed you wrote your college thesis on propaganda in the 2004 Russian elections. That seems like a kind of remarkable coincidence. You must have there must be a leg up on all of that.
You know, I'll be totally transparent about that. I double majored. I did computer science and political science. I minored in global studies or something like that. I don't remember what the specific title was, but I took Russian for 3 years. And at the time, I was practicing by like reading Russian newspapers, and I was trying to find a graduation thesis topic. That was absolutely transparently. That was it. I was like, oh God, what am I going to do?
Right.
You know, well, here's this political event happening in Russia, and I can read the newspapers and I can think about it. And the interesting insight there was, this was also when music streaming was, Napster, and, you know, I was in college in 2004. So all of these things were kind of hot. And so I was also trying to find like interesting music and things, and I found these bands that were singing these pro-Putin songs. Mm. It felt like the kind of nascent technologies were, you know, reaching young people was they were reaching young people in very different ways. And I was just interested in it and looking for a project. So that's how that happened, totally by accident.
So the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, they wanted to learn certain things. I mean, there are a couple of forms that the Russians used to interfere: hacking online voting systems, targeting cyber attacks of the Democratic National Committee. The one you focused on, though, is this social influence operation. Talk about where you started and where you got your material. I guess this was data you were focused on, the biggies, right? Facebook and Twitter and others.
Yeah. So in 2017, I did some of the work with Tristan Harris and others trying to get the tech hearings called. Yeah. And that was because we felt that there was a need for kind of a public accounting for what had happened in the 2016 election. And that's because it had become so politicized by that point that there were actually vast, you know, maybe vast is the wrong word, but there were small and perhaps noisy segments of the population that really firmly believed that this was all a myth, that this hadn't happened. And so the question became like, well, who knows what happened? And the answer is the social platforms, because they have the data, but they're not sharing with each other. So there's no cohesive analysis across platforms of what happened. You know, we said like, you know, maybe they'll turn the data set over to the Senate and then the Senate can analyze it, or, you know, some government body can analyze it. And that was how it happened. They decided that they wanted outside researchers to look as well. So that was where myself and then a team led by Graphica and Oxford Internet Institute, we were all given access to the same data, but we were kept separate, in fact, because they wanted to see two independent reports to see if our conclusions reflected the same thing. And this was a way to try to avoid allegations of political bias, you know, or something, particularly since the early indications were that the data was going to show that that much of what happened was in support of a Trump candidacy. Mm. So the platforms turned over their content. A lot of it was time-bounded, so it was from 2015 till autumn 2017 when the request was made. So we got 10.5 million tweets, got about 1,100 YouTube videos, 16,000 Instagram posts, and 62,000 Facebook posts. So this, the data was provided to the Senate. It was you know, a couple hundred gigs, 400 gigs or so of material. And then the question became, what do we do with it? How do we analyze it? And that was where the two independent teams came in, and we took different approaches, which I think was great. I really enjoyed reading their paper as well, but arrived at many of the same conclusions.
What is the Internet Research Agency? First of all, give us a little bit of background on that and what we know about where they came from and their initial, you know, ideas at first.
Yeah, so the Internet Research Agency is not a official entity of the Russian government. That's something that I think is misconstrued sometimes. It works extremely closely with the Russian government, though perhaps not officially. So there's a thing that we have in the U.S. called kind of independent expenditure, where you can't coordinate with a campaign, but they act in support of a campaign. I think of the IRA a little bit as like that. So they're not necessarily being told specifically what to do. We don't know that. You know, I don't know that we've found any evidence that they are specifically instructed by Putin or the Kremlin on what to do, but they operate in strategic alignment with those interests. And they are basically a social media agency staffed up by younger people, mostly actually in their 30s, late 20s, early 30s, based on the ones who have come out and been whistleblowers. And their job is to create social media content. So originally, this entity was created to propagandize to Russian and Ukrainian citizens in sort of the regional sphere of influence. So they would leave comments on Russian, Ukrainian newspapers, newspaper articles, pushing a particular point of view about things like Crimea or MH17, the Malaysian Airlines flight that came down, that was shot down. So they were basically working to manufacture consensus about particular events that happened of interest to where the Russian government wanted the people to think a certain way. And so that is how they kind of came into existence. And then in around 2014, they began to turn their energy to the U.S. as well. And the first real expose of the Internet Research Agency was actually written in June 2015. So the idea that we didn't know that they existed is just wrong. Yeah. The idea that we didn't know that they were targeting Americans is also just wrong. We didn't know at the time the extent of the operation, but there were very clear indications that they were pushing particular narratives, a lot about Russian policy in the Middle East and Syria, pushing that out to American audiences. They were using things like celebrity culture to grow pages. And Adrian Chen's article, which was, I think, the Times Magazine, was an excellent expose because they actually wound up targeting him and creating propagandistic narratives about him. Why is they had a, I believe it was a, Russian white supremacist, kind of neo-Nazi figure, show up to a meeting that he had at a coffee shop as the quote-unquote brother of the woman that he was meeting. And then the way that a photographer surreptitiously took pictures from the outside kind of cut the woman out of the image and just showed a New York Times reporter meeting with a Russian neo-Nazi, and then wrote articles about why is, in Russian media about why is the New York Times meeting Russian neo-Nazis. So this is how the sausage is made. Yeah. And there were indications that this kind of thing was happening. The idea that it was a mass, I think 200 and something accounts that we know about operation, that wasn't really known in 2015.
You mentioned in the report the scale of the operation was unprecedented. Say a little bit more about that. We're talking like 126 million Facebook users and 20 million on Instagram. I mean, give us a sense of the scale of that.
Yeah, so those numbers come from the platform. That's Facebook's estimates, 126 million users on Facebook and 20 million users on Instagram engaged with the content. The 20 million on Instagram is an interesting number because Instagram doesn't have automatic sharing, meaning there's no button you click where you share the meme with your friends. But the engagements on Instagram were actually higher. So when we talk about engagements, we're talking about not just the content showing up in people's feeds, but people actually doing something with the content. So they're clicking a like button, they're sharing it, they are commenting, or they're leaving a reaction of some sort, like those little emojis. So there were about 187 million engagements on Instagram, 77 million engagements on Facebook, and then 73 million engagements with the original content on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So on Twitter, of course, out of the 10.5 million tweets, about 4 million of those were retweets, were just them amplifying particular points of view. They created about 6 million original tweets. There have, of course, been other entities that have run manipulation campaigns before. The Russians are not the first. The kind of unprecedented scale of what Russia did was just that this was so expansive and so multi-year. A lot of when we see these operations, they're kind of turned on and turned off for a particular moment in time. But this was a multi-year effort, a multi-channel effort everywhere on the internet, every social platform they could be, to create tribalism and develop relationships with Americans. This wasn't just we're going to push out some news to make some money with ad fraud during an election, which is more what we saw from other groups.
I get why they might target, right-leaning groups or left-leaning groups, but it's interesting. You say the group they seemed most intent on targeting were African Americans. Talk about that.
So the data is really interesting. It's up on disinformationreport.com. And for people who just want to see the charts, we have a slide deck in there. They really prioritized building immersive, interlocking media environments for the African American community. A lot of their top performing pages on Facebook were the ones that targeted the right. So it's interesting. The far greater effort expended on interlocking these pages for the Black community. And what I mean by that is if you followed one African-American targeted account, let's Blackstagram, for example, was one of them. And if you followed Blackstagram, which was actually their highest performing Instagram account, what you would see was reappropriation of content, resharing of content, tagging of other accounts that they owned. And they would say things like, here's a post by my friends Williams and Calvin. And Williams and Calvin was another internet research agency account. Here's a post by our friends at Black Matters. Here's a post by our friends at, they had so many. Woke Blacks was one. Nefertiti's Community was another. So one of the things that was interesting about the targeting of the African American community was they didn't do it monolithically. It wasn't just like, oh, we're going to put out Black Lives Matter, fake Black Lives Matter groups. They really got in there and did a ton of research, and they found particular sub-communities. So there was a liberation theology page. There was a page for Baptists. There was a page for women with incarcerated spouses. There was a page for women who were interested in culture, so more of like hair and makeup and that sort of thing. One for kind of elevating Black dads. Once you were in it, you were going to get cross-promoted propaganda from all of their other accounts, which they were also setting up to just look like additional Black media pages. So it was That sort of interlocking and interconnectedness of accounts was really something that they kind of pioneered and ran with that community. We saw a little bit of that with Follow My Friends on Instagram, and Follow My Friends, you'd see the right-leaning accounts would say, follow my three friends, and they would name three other accounts. But it was much less well-executed. It was much less of a immersive, constant resharing of content.
That their efforts to suppress the vote, that was interesting in the report. Talk a little bit about that. You mentioned there are three different storylines or different tactics there that they would put together. One was getting out a message, look, your vote really doesn't matter. There was another one about just kind of creating this confusion, urging them to vote for a third-party candidate. That was interesting, too.
Yeah, they were Jill Stein. It was Jill Stein. So the way that laid out on Twitter was where you saw the kind of blatant, kind of fraudulent, you know, lies about polling places and election dates and, you know, these crazy things that they would put out saying if you had voted for Bernie in the primary, you couldn't go vote for Hillary, you know, you couldn't change your vote. It's particularly targeting Latino populations, it seemed, based on the Twitter data. On the Facebook pages and the Instagram accounts and YouTube as well, they reached out with these alienation, I would say, was one of the themes. So there was tribalism and alienation. Mm-hmm. So they would reinforce community. So if you were a member of one of the Black pages, you would be hearing constantly, like, as Black people, we love this. As Black people, we do that. And that extended to the content about politics. Mm-hmm. So there was a steady drumbeat leading into the election of stories of police brutality. And a lot of and then other stories of kind of elevating this is what the media doesn't want you to see. So positive stories of Black youths and Black women. And interspersed in that were as Black people, this country isn't for us, so we are not going to vote. You know, Williams and Calvin put out a video called A Word of Truth. And the Word of Truth, that was kind of their theme, A Word of Truth about and then X. They would pick a topic. And there were a lot of words of truth about how a vote for Jill Stein was not a wasted vote. Hillary Clinton had blood on her hands. Hillary Clinton didn't really like Black people. Hillary Clinton's husband had led to the incarceration of Black people. So there are these things that there's sort of maybe a kernel of truth that they can get, and then they kind of lean into that and kind of expand out from it. And that's how propaganda works. Mm-hmm. You always want to find something that's true because it prevents people from dismissing it out of hand. So if you can find historical statements or comments or things to reinforce your point of view, they'll lean into that and take it and manipulate it. And so that was so what we saw was the three types of suppression were the kind of the nonsense on Twitter with the just blatant, like, election day is November 10th or whatever.
Right.
Or the and then on Facebook, it was more don't vote. This country isn't for us. And if you do feel like you have to vote, you need to vote for Jill Stein. And what was interesting about this was at the same time they were running this kind of suppression, don't vote narrative on the left-leaning, well, particularly the African-American targeted pages, on the far-right pages, it was all about anger. It was furious. The content was like, Hillary Clinton is going to steal the election. There's voter fraud. They're busing in illegals. Incandescent rage on all of the accounts. It was really something to see just on Twitter as well. Just these virulent troll accounts out there attacking Comey because they were really, really just the fact that he didn't indict her was just a source of absolute rage. And they really picked up on that. And that was when they started going hard after Comey as well. And so you start to see they always were working to discredit establishment Republicans and establishment investigators and things like that. But there were so many allegations of voter fraud. It was really something to see. It was so angry. And so you have this kind of nihilism targeting one group, this, like, it doesn't matter, like, whatever, let's all just stay home. And then on the other side, rage to really drive turnout there.
The report mentions how they would recruit and develop these assets. So, and this was a priority for them, you say. Basically, they would encourage people to go out and hand out flyers. I mean, perform particular tasks.
Yeah, there was a lot of direct outreach. So I think it's another, it's an interesting, that was interesting to me because if you think back to the Cold War, the, you know, the idea of infiltrating protest organizations and activist organizations, this is not new. Yeah. This is something that, you know, the KGB's done for a very long time. So to see the Internet Research Agency do it, this is where you do start to see, we have no evidence of like explicit coordination, I don't think, but the ways in which the GRU side of the operation and the Internet Research Agency side of the operation kind of come together. So you have that kind of asset recruitment is much more traditionally seen in intelligence. You don't really see social media marketing agencies going out and saying like, listen, for your protest, we're going to hire a woman dressed like Hillary Clinton to sit in a cage at a rally and we're going to pay for it. And that, you know, so there's that, but it's to do it so surreptitiously. So they were really infiltrating activist communities, offering money, offering resources, and then connecting with people and saying, we want you to amplify our message. So they wanted to really build brands around their activism. And they weren't just trying to stay in the realm of the online. They were trying to drive people to the streets. They were actively trying to shape what was happening in the streets, particularly around things like the innumerable protests. I can't even quantify. There are hundreds of them where they would put up these posts for people to come and rally and march in support of victims of police violence. And some of them were new. Some of them were kind of these breaking stories that, unfortunately, these terrible tragedies, as they emerge, they would kind of immediately co-opt. They would run an ad targeting the community where the violence had just occurred, you know, saying like, okay, we got to go march. But they were also dredging up atrocities from, you know, 2-3 years prior. So they would have marches of anniversaries of deaths and things like that. One of the things that they did was they actually held two opposing rallies on the same day. So they sponsored a Texas secessionist rally, and then they sponsored simultaneously an Islamic pride rally at, I believe it was an Islamic center in Houston, I think, somewhere in Texas. And they literally set up two Facebook event pages on the same day at the same time across the street, trying to get these two kind of, you know, polar opposite groups to come out and fight. You know, it wasn't really spun as a fight. It was like, we're going to have our march. And then entirely separately, we're going to have our march. And I think that the idea was like, each would see the other's march and feel that their point of view, their, you know, identity was under attack. A lot of this was about identity in America.
Yeah.
And that was where that tribalism, that tribal reinforcement really came in. And even the merchandise was designed, you know, they had these T-shirt shops where they would sell merchandise where you could literally wear your politics right across your chest, you know, and again, kind of walk down the street, both building their brand and putting out these kind of like sometimes sensational or incendiary content that they would put on the T-shirts. So it was about growing tribes and, you know, really a lot of really tough, real conversations that they just kind of got in there and manipulated.
I have to ask you about one of the techniques I found so strange, but also really sophisticated. And it was this idea of how they would influence someone and recruit an asset, basically, by exploiting their personal vulnerabilities, like using a secret to cause shame or create these hotlines, in some cases, people struggling with sexual behavior. Like, how did that fit? How was that influential?
That's another old KGB technique. So if you're going to recruit an asset, if you're an intelligence officer, you're going to find some vulnerability that makes that person subject to blackmail that, you know, will make them do what you want them to do. Yeah. That was how it was done in old kind of Cold War and just modern intelligence, too. So what we saw online was these intelligence-style tactics, the infiltration of activist communities, and then the recruitment of people. And then with this, it was like the LGBT pages would have these, if you're struggling, DM us. The Christian page ran this meme 2 or 3 times about if you're addicted to masturbation.
Right.
Now, the thing that was that wasn't an accident. So there is sort of like these like meme inceptions that happen here. That meme was not created by them.
Are you talking about you can't hold hands with God when you're masturbating? Is that one of the...
Well, there, yes, it's that, but it says, join us and we'll beat it together.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, so there are these double entendres there. Yeah. That is not an accident. So the so that was not created by them. It was grabbed and used by them.
Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting, it was used three, I think, separate times on the page. I imagine that they thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think gets lost in a lot of this is that a lot of the content was really funny.
Yeah.
And you had to imagine, especially when they were making the memes about like, oh, it was the Russians, my speedometer is broken, blame the Russians, you know, particularly when they were kind of meta trolling about the idea that Russians could be involved. Like, you imagine them sitting there having a great time doing this, because it's, you know, coming up with these this funny content and then grabbing from far right content that says exactly what they want it to say and then using it. With the masturbation meme, we couldn't see the comments. So we know that it had tons of engagement. We know that they ran it at least three times. So they reran some of their winners. You know, if it got high engagement, they would rerun it. The page was a very earnest Christian page. It wasn't like a tongue-in-cheek, mocking kind of page. So again, I can't see what the comments were. I don't know if people were laughing about it or recognized the irony. But they did, you know, they were encouraging people, like, DM us, we're here to help. And so that was the part that they kind of added. So they did take this meme that was kind of I believe it was an unintentional joke, but a joke. And then began to kind of push it out. And since it resonated, push it out again and again and again, and then get comments and possibly get DMs, who knows. But again, when you have that type of thing, they're looking for areas, you know, the intelligence, the kind of spy tradecraft aspect of that is the idea that you find someone who has a vulnerability and then you develop a relationship with them. And so if you are doing this on a page with LGBT people, where there was none of the kind of tongue-in-cheek mocking tone to the meme, that was just a straight up, like, DM us if you're struggling with your sexuality. And so it's creepy, actually.
Yeah.
Is what it is.
Yeah.
And we can't see those messages. We don't know who they engaged with. We don't know what happened next. But it was clear that it was a tactic that they were willing to try.
Is there any way of telling? I'm thinking about when I would look at a television news report of a rally and see, you know, the camera pans across the audience and I'm seeing all of these T-shirts or all of these banners. Is there any way of telling what fraction of those were organic and organized by Americans, or how much of this was influenced by the Russians to get these assets and create these rallies? I mean, is there any way of telling what proportion is which?
Not really. I mean, I would say the vast majority is real organic American
yeah.
activity. That's because, like we discussed earlier, they are amplifying or exacerbating, but not creating the underlying discord. Look, the idea of, like, Hillary for prison, that was not created by Russia.
Right.
What we see over and over again is a deep commitment. You know, Facebook said $100,000 worth of ads. Now, the thing that's fascinating about that is at the time, to me, that seemed very, you know, in 2017, when they made that statement, that seemed very like they were trying to diminish it almost. And I think about that still. And I think that yes, they could have perhaps done a better job of explaining that translated into 187 million engagements and that the organic content is what mattered. But they actually didn't have visibility into the full scope of the resources devoted to this. So there is this crazy, you know, the $100,000 has become like a meme at this point by people who want to diminish it. No, it's only $100,000 of ads. No, it was a $25 million operation. They had, I think it was like $10 million in 2016, and then they increased their spend in 2017 and 2018 leading into the U.S. midterms. You don't increase your spend if you think you achieved bad results.
Right.
And so there is by their standards, they seem to think they had some success. And the challenge, the question of impact, is always the hardest to quantify. Mm-hmm. And we are very, very transparent about that in our report, and Oxford was in their report as well. And that's because we can say all of these people saw it. We can say all of these people showed up to rallies or, you know, held up signs with their slogans on them and things like that. But we don't know, you know, to what extent it changed minds, to right. what extent it kept people home. There's still a whole lot more we have to understand about this particular operation, and that's being done kind of as the puzzle pieces come together across the different investigations and just sort of with more time.
But that is the question you get the most, I'm sure. That is the question most of us want to know. Did this work? Did it swing the election, this Russian project?
Yeah, I get that question all the time, and the answer is I don't know.
Yep.
Do I think it was well executed? Yes. Yes, I do. And I think that one of the things that I alluded to was the continued prevalence of those memes in the targeted communities. That was, they picked it up and they amplified it to whatever extent they possibly could, including paying for a human to sit in a cage at a rally. They had interesting ideas about kind of marketing theatrics that they basically served up to local activists so that they would get press and so it would be sensationalized. A lot of what I did during the course of the research, and honestly still kind of continue to do, is when things like the indictments, the Mueller indictments, I look at what they had versus what we saw. So one of the things that I do is I look for ongoing influence operations, and I did a lot of that in 2018 as the midterms were coming up. And so one of the things that that I did was looked at visual similarity, image clustering, basically. So looking at, hey, here's a page, and when we look at its content, it's 60% Russian memes from other IRA pages. So when we kind of scroll back down in time and we look at the content that they were posting in 2016, 2017, it's just kind of a substantial quantity of the content came from the Russian pages. Now, the challenge is, like, within those communities, the Russian pages were actually, in some of the communities, some of the pages were very successful. Blackstagram, in particular, had a whole lot of success just when we look at, the audience, the kind of Black community audience, the audiences they were targeting, they did reach. A lot of the times the conversation turns into, like, this was a very small percentage of the total content on Facebook at the time. And that is also objectively true. Mm-hmm. But the question becomes, where is the analysis of within the Black community, how was the engagement of Blackstagram compared to the engagement of a real authentic Black media entity at the time? And these are the sorts of things that we're still working on and still trying to figure out, because that kind of stuff is not included in the data set. And so it's more a matter of kind of going back and trying to find other tools and benchmarks and ways to gauge how successful they were at penetration in the communities they wanted. And then with that, on the impact front, when we see these pages that were sharing 60%, IRA memes at the time, the question becomes, is that also an IRA page? Is that a fellow traveler or, somebody who just happens to be ideologically aligned that was grabbing this stuff? Or is it someone who did have a relationship with, maybe Blackstagram reached out to them and said, hey, like, you share our content, we'll share yours, because we know that they did that. These sort of cross promotions with real Black media. So that's another example of, like, were these pages in contact with Russian pages? Are they Russian pages? It's really hard to figure out what's real on the internet, and that's kind of the ongoing challenge. Becomes this is where, when Facebook says this is a hard problem, it is absolutely true. It is a very hard problem, and it's only in partnership with researchers and government agencies that have some insights into this, like the Department of Justice and the FBI, that we have any kind of hope of detection going forward.
These societal fractures aren't going anywhere, so there's always going to be some organization willing to amplify them and manipulate them, I guess. One of the things you've mentioned was it's naive to think social media companies are not going to be leaving society. So I guess finally, you're always going to be dealing with this. I mean, this is the new reality, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's an arms race. And every time a platform changes a feature, the adversary finds a way to evade it or move against it. So one example of this would be the Internet Research Agency. Back in 2015, we're buying ads to draw audiences to pages, right? Facebook requires certain disclosures for ads now that it didn't until kind of early last year. what's going to happen, I think, in that particular case is you're going to see some people try to launder their ads by basically creating, you know, LLCs that look more legitimate. And so they will adhere to the letter of the law. And then the other thing that I think that they can do in that case is just avoid ads altogether, because the ads were a means to an end. They were a means to grow an audience. If you have Facebook groups, you already have an identified standing audience. You can just go and you can kind of infiltrate the Facebook group and you can push your propaganda directly to people and establish, you know, a page or a community, or even just kind of nudge an existing community in a particular direction. You don't need the ads. So this is an example, just one example of how the platform changes the rules of engagement by making one tactic more difficult. And then the adversary evolves to go about it in a different way. And that's where, when we talk about this is not going anywhere, there are billions of people on social, you know, 2 billion people, I think, on Facebook. There are these large standing audiences. They are easy to reach and target. You know, you can find out a lot of information if you want to reach particular communities. You can find out where they are. And then the algorithms will amplify. So if you find people, you get a certain number of people who have liked your Facebook page, your Texas Secessionist Facebook page, Facebook will just begin to recommend it in the recommendation engine, serving it up to people who might have an interest in Texas Secession. So these sort of three factors, the consolidation of audiences, the gameable algorithms, and then the ability to reach people, the precision targeting, those three things together, that's not going anywhere. So we just have to come up with ways to mitigate some of these problems and mitigate some of the other harms, the harms that are not related to disinformation. But when it comes to disinformation, find ways to pull together those separate bases of knowledge to have a fighting chance.
Renee DiResta, she's director of research at New Knowledge, a cybersecurity company which conducted an independent investigation for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. It's called the Disinformation Report. She joined us from a studio in San Francisco. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.